Welcome to our Higgins Haven podcast, a Friday the 13th podcast. My name is Jason Parker. I am the webmaster for FridayThe13thFranchise.com. And today's episode, episode 5, we're going to talk to actor Eric Anderson, who played Rob Dyer in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. So why don't we go ahead and we'll jump right into our interview with Eric.
And today I have a very special guest, Eric Anderson, who played the character of Rob in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Thank you for taking some time out today to talk to us, Eric.
No problem.
The very first thing I wanted to start off with, and I found this really interesting for me, is I had just learned that you were born in Japan. Is that correct?
I was. I was a military brat, as many of my fellow thespians are. I'm married to a woman actually whose father is a retired 3-star Marine Corps general. And,
oh, wow.
It's just we've lived in many places in our lives, and I think that adaptation of being able to just throw yourself into whatever situation presents itself leads you to choose professions that kind of may have a kind of a freelance thing associated with it as opposed to something that you go to every day.
Definitely. My father was stationed in the Air Force in Germany, so I was actually born in Germany.
In Augsburg or?
Wiesbaden.
Oh, really? In Wiesbaden. Yeah, wow. I know a couple of people that were born there, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But that's really, it's really interesting. And like you say, it really kind of opens your eyes, you know, as you're younger and professionally as you get older to, you know, being able to see different things. A lot of times people, when they're born in the United States, they almost kind of in a bubble of sorts. You know, they grow up in one town and see one thing a certain way, but definitely lends itself to you as you get older.
You're forced to adapt, that's for sure.
definitely. And the other thing that maybe some of the readers on my website may not know is that you actually hold a BA in biochemistry and molecular biology.
Yeah, exactly. I have a degree in biochemistry and molecular biology from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And then when I first got out of college, I went to work at USC School of Medicine with the intention that I'd just matriculate there. And I didn't really dig it. So
okay.
I moved out of that. And, you know, I had been an actor when I was a youngster, when I was doing stage productions and stuff when I was 12, 13 years old and subsequently, you know, through high school and things like that. But I never considered it to be, you know, something that it seemed too pie in the sky for me at the time. And
okay.
I had an aptitude in science, so I kind of followed that path for a while until I could not follow it any longer. And that led me back into the theater and eventually back into being an actor almost 30 years ago. So,
wow, that's amazing. And that's kind of like what I was going to ask, too, is, you know, after you filmed Friday the 13th Final Chapter, I mean, you've been in numerous television shows like, you know, Murder, She Wrote, CSI, NCIS.
300 episodes of TV to this point, yeah.
It's amazing. And, you know, one of your very first gigs was Friday the 13th Final Chapter, and I was just curious, you know, how exactly that came about, you know, how were you called up to audition for the film and how that went?
You know, it's a pretty good story. It was just one of those things, you know. I had finally moved to L.A. After I worked in the aircraft industry for a while. I did some other stuff.
Okay.
And then I finally moved to L.A. And it took me about – I did a play that was very successful, and that got me some representation. And then I did a TV pilot, and then I did a television series called Bay City Blues, which is kind of a offshoot from Hill Street Blues, but it was about a minor league baseball team.
Okay.
And so I had some aptitude in baseball, so that kind of really helped me get cast on that show. And I was doing that, and along came this audition for this movie, for this horror film, and I went to the audition on a Friday afternoon, and I remember I was headed to the Bay Area, because a lot of guys that I'd gone to college with had moved there, and I was going up to – I'm a big baseball fan, so I was going up to see a series the Padres were playing, San Diego Padres were playing with the Giants at Candlestick Park. And so
okay.
I actually had someone in the car downstairs ready to drive us to the airport to go up there. And the character that I was playing on Bay City Blues, I had this mustache, and it was kind of one of the older characters on the show. with some really good actors of our time, and it was all our first show. And then I went to this audition, and there was Pam Basker and Fern Champion, and there was Joe Zito. And I did the audition. I thought it went okay. I didn't really think. All I had were the sides for the character. All I had were the scenes that these two scenes that Rob was in. And I think that was the when he introduces himself first to Tommy, and then the scene with Tommy in the bedroom. I think those are the two scenes that we did the audition with. And I just then forgot about it. I went off to San Francisco and went to the baseball game, came back the following week, and my manager had called me and said, you know, they're really interested in you in this. And I thought, okay, I was really kind of confused. And I found out later from Joe and Pamela and Fern that from the moment that I walked in, they decided kind of like I was the guy. I mean, this is what I can remember from it. Jason, this is 30 years ago, so.
Definitely, I understand, yes.
It's like, you know. Anyway, so the bottom line is that they called and they said, you know, you've got the job. And I went, okay. And then I read the script. And I didn't know that the script said that, you know, the last 40 scenes of the picture were Night Rain. Exterior Night Rain.
Definitely. And, you know, part of that, and I was going to touch on that later, but we can definitely do that now, is I think on one of the interviews that you did for one of the DVDs within the last few years, you actually mentioned the fact that you just felt like you were constantly having water poured on you. And I was just curious, you know, did they actually just have buckets of water that they were just pouring on you before the take would start? Or did they have like a machine or how did
No, they had like a insect sprayer.
Okay.
You know, like one of those things you kind of pump up and it sprays a stream. And they would try to fill that with hot water or with warm water.
Mm-hmm.
And because you have to get, you know, completely drenched before we'd even start shooting. And we were in Topanga Canyon. We were also in Upper Franklin Canyon Reservoir and for the exterior night stuff. And, you know, it was December, January, November. It was freezing. It was cold. So they would just spray you with water, and then you'd be wet for, you know, hours upon hours. I got like the cold flu thing. The very first first week we were back in L.A. after we were up in Zocca Lake, and that kind of inured me after that. I was able to pretty much handle it. But I felt, you know, I mean, here's Kimberly was wearing a short dress, you know.
Right. Yeah. No. I had
pants and a shirt on, you know.
I mean, and that's the thing is with this shoot especially, I mean, you talk to a lot of the people or you listen to interviews or read about their experiences, and, you know, it was a rough shoot. I mean, it was kind of a very physical shoot as well besides the elements themselves. And I guess I was going to ask
But we were young, you know, and we were up for anything kind of in a lot of ways, you know. It was
a lot
of our first movies, you know. It was our first movie for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure it was really exciting, too, just kind of, especially knowing it was kind of a Paramount distributed film and that, you know, a lot of people were going to see it. I definitely could see where everybody was just kind of like, yeah, let's just do it, you know, and have fun with it as much as you could. I guess what I was going to ask you, too, was about, you know, director Joe Zito. I think you had mentioned in an interview one time that he was, during the audition process, that he was kind of nicknamed Francis after Francis Ford Coppola. Because
yeah, I think
was,
that Pam and because I think they saw like 300 guys for Rob, and how it ended up being me, I can't tell you.
Sure,
but it just kept going. The casting process kept going. I think Fern and Pamela got a little frustrated after a period of time, you know.
Especially it being a Friday the 13th film, where you know up until this point, you know, for this film, you know, it really wasn't a painstaking process. They were just looking for, you know, young people who were
fresh young faces, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And so and with Joe, you know, he's very meticulous in his films, looking for the right people. And that's the one thing at least I appreciate about him with this movie was, even though it's a Friday the 13th film and there's a formula to it, that he actually cared about making a good film. And
that's
so,
how Joe
you know,
did everything, just so you know. I mean, that was Joe. I went off and did Missing in Action with Joe later on. This is a long story. But the bottom line is that Joe really did try to get – he understood the genre that he was shooting in, and he understood what it was that he was – the story that he was trying to tell. And that goes back to I think I might have mentioned this, but the very first night when we were in Buellton, we were up in, you know, outside of Solvang, and we're going to shoot all the lake sequence stuff with the swimming.
Oh,
with
sure.
The skinny dipping we shot that first day. We shot the stuff on the drive where I come out of the woods and meet them for the first time because their car is broken down.
Oh, yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all being done that first day. And then the toe shot of us when I talk about that I'm hunting bear.
Okay.
Okay, that day was the very first day we were shooting up. And we were up in northern Santa Barbara County or eastern Santa Barbara County. And Joe had come to me, and I think Pamela had, or Fern did, maybe it was Pamela, who had also come up when we first started. And they talked about the theory and all the what they were trying to achieve with Rob's character. I think what they were trying to achieve with everyone's character, they had a very, very specific thing that they were trying to do. And with Rob, it was, we don't want the audience to cheer when Rob dies.
Right.
We, you know, because they will, he said, you know, they will cheer and they will applaud, and I'm going to give it to them, you know, when all the kids die. But when Rob dies, we want to send the audience into another level of terror, because all that's left now is a woman, a young woman, and her son, and her brother, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your death scene, really, I mean, even to this day, I know that there's two sides.
A lot of controversy there, yeah.
Yeah, two sides of fandom, you know, on that. You know, for me personally, I think it's still a really powerful scene. I mean, you're right. It's one of those scenes where your jaw kind of drops and you're like, wow, this guy he's dying. You know, you really feel it. Mm-hmm. But then there's other fans who kind of laugh at the fact that your character in that film would actually yell out.
That would be something so redundant.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting. And it's funny with that, too, is, you know, Joe Zito even mentioned in an interview himself where he kind of got that idea from, that he'd seen that in some sort of a news report that somebody, you know, a police or someone had showed up and, you know, they were saying something to that effect, like, you know, I'm dying or something like that.
No, it was one of those things in New York where a guy, you know, was walking down the street and somebody came out of an alley and started stabbing him, and he screamed, he's killing me, he's killing me.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
Everyone that was in the apartments all around the thing kind of opened their blinds and looked out and then closed their blinds again.
Amazing.
And
that's
that
amazing.
Really horrified. That was really something that was very potent. Joe was kind of horrified by humanity in that moment.
I agree. I totally agree with that.
And he tried to kind of recreate that. You know what the funny thing is that because the way the film was shot, we went way over on the schedule. You know, it just kept going on, which made other people, you know, obviously think that Joe, you know, he's making Friday the 13th, but Joe really, he really believed that this was going to be the best one, you know, and he was going to, you know, do it. And yeah, that's the sequence at the very end of the film where Tommy kills Jason, where I have to lay on the ground. I have to get hosed down and lay on the ground. Went on for like 8 shooting days, it seemed like.
Oh, my goodness.
So I would be there every day in costume, made up, blood, post-death, though my character was dead, I was basically an extra in the scene while that was going on. And they would come to me and say, we're not going to see your side of the room. And I would just, you know, I was reading books or doing whatever I was doing at the time. And
sure.
But in the very beginning when it was happening, they would always call us in because Joe really wasn't sure what he was going to get to that day. And so the schedule might have said one thing, but what we ended up shooting was always something a little different. So they owned us. They could do whatever they wanted. And so they brought us in. They pretty much brought us all in every day. And so I got an opportunity to follow Tom Savini around. And he would show me, oh, this is how I'm going to kill Crispin. This is how I'm going to kill Lawrence. This is how I'm going to do these things. And I said, well, how are you going to kill me? He goes, yeah, we haven't talked about that yet. And what I didn't know at the time was that they never intended to do what was in the script, which was my flesh being ripped away by a 3-pronged gardening harrow.
Okay.
That they never planned. I don't think they planned to do it. They wanted this to be a more psychological death than the other ones that we had seen to this point. And that led to me that dialogue in that moment. So you could say it's improvised, but it kind of happened right before we shot it. Joe goes, "This is what I want to do."
I see. Okay. Okay.
You don't have the budget to have the close up of me being and Tom Savini might have been gone at that point or whatever. But I think that was planned. I think that Joe had a specific idea of what he was trying to do there.
Okay. You know? No, I mean, And it works. It totally works, in my opinion. It really is. And his goal of setting out to make, you know, the best one in the franchise, a lot of people will still tell you today that he really did. So
yeah, when I go to – when I've been to a couple of these conventions, and I'm you know, I noticed that you said that someone was going to be at – oh, Harry Manfredini was going to be at Horror Hound. I think that I'm going to be at Horror Hound too, so –
Oh really? Oh, okay.
In Cincinnati,
great.
I think
awesome.
That I think that I just heard the other day that I think I could be there, and but they all the people that come up to me, they always the plaudits for part four, you know, are always really the people are very specific that part four is their favorite.
Yeah,
they like seven. They like seven, and they don't like five.
Yeah, that's a film that really you either go one way or another. There's no gray area with that film, unfortunately. So
yeah, I never saw it, so I could tell you.
When for the duration of the shoot, I believe it was supposed to be a 6-week shoot, and it went about to about 12 weeks. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. I think, on a 6-week schedule.
Okay. Did you?
And I think we actually had Christmas and came back and continued shooting through January, which is a really big deal.
Yeah.
You know, because certain people, and that's the other thing, I was carried for all 12 weeks. There were other characters that were killed off earlier that might have been there for 2 or 3. But we didn't do that last sequence of Tommy killing Jason and my death and all that stuff was all after the kids were killed.
Oh,
and
I see. Okay.
And Mrs. Jarvis was killed, and everything was all kind of done before that. So now it's just me and Kimberly and Corey and Ted, and that's it for like the last 2.5 weeks of shooting. 2 weeks.
How was that? What was it like just being with them for those last couple of weeks?
Well, I get along with everybody, so it wasn't a problem. And I really liked Kimberly, and I think my car was broken down at the time, so we would always she'd pick me up, and we rode together a lot. And Ted and I got along because he had a little kind of card game going, and I would get into it. He took a lot of my money, my drive to money, I think, during that period of time. He knew he had a sucker on the line when I showed up. So. And I got to watch him because he was the film guy. He was the guy who really knew the nuts and bolts of filmmaking way down to what – that was one of the things I would watch Ted and see is that he knew what was going to be on camera. He knew what wasn't going to be on camera, how you could fake something to make it look real. All this stuff. It was the education that I got from working on this movie because I was there all the time and because I got to hang around with all these interesting artists.
Right.
That sustained me for my entire career, you know. It really was that, more than anything, that was the most important part of my development, was experiencing how this is, the nuts and bolts of how something like this gets done, you know.
I mean, that's great, and really that's, you know, not just in film, but, you know, I guess with any profession that you're in, that it should be like that, your first
yeah, you're
job
the apprentice, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so that's great. I mean, now, you hear stories of some other actors, not just specifically in this kind of a film franchise, but in movies in general, who don't have that good experience in their first couple roles. And so it's kind of interesting to hear that.
I work with them all the time. You know, and I try to treat them. I try to treat them the way that, you know, Ted would have treated me had I not observed him. You know, is that this is how you do it. You know, this is what your responsibility is at this moment. You know. Because there's 100 people here that are depending on you to get this right.
Right, yeah, and you know, Ted's such a no-nonsense guy. His son was actually on a podcast, I think a year ago, and was telling a story about him on one of the sets that he was doubling John Wayne, and how he just didn't agree with what was going on set, and I guess Ted had actually saved some lady and her kid on the set. They were out in Africa somewhere. And I guess John Wayne didn't like the fact that he was, you know, kind of the man of the moment. And so they got into a little fight, and Ted walked away, and that was the last time you worked with John Wayne, I guess, as a stunt double. And just that kind of a presence on a set really, like you say, is you listen to the guy. You watch him, and you respect him for that. So.
And I know he might have had frustrations with because, you know, I mean, this movie is supposed to be 6 weeks, and we're 12 weeks into it. So, and he was there for a lot of that. So, you know, you got paid by the week in those days. You didn't get paid overall. I don't know if he might have got paid differently than we did, but we always got paid just, you know, scale. And and the people that worked 3 weeks got 3 weeks of scale, and the people that worked 12 got 12 weeks of scale, you know.
Okay.
So I don't think that was the case with Ted. I think Ted got paid differently than the way everyone else did. I mean, I can only assume, because I can imagine at his age and everything that he would do it for that, where
definitely.
The rest of us were grateful to have to get paid scale. But I remember there was one instance where he felt like somebody was in peril in something, and he said something to Joe, and there was this kind of kerfuffle that happened at one point. I wasn't around for it, but I heard about that.
Yeah, the actress Judy Aronson, I guess, was doing her rap scene.
Completely
nude. And, yeah, I guess it was, like you say, it was like 20, 30 degrees out late at night, and she'd been in the water, she's naked, and he just kind of, you know, Ted just said, this is enough, you know, she's going to get sick, you know, she's going to get hypothermia, and yeah, so he got into a little scuffle with Joe about that, and he got her out of there, out of the lake so she could warm up. But, yeah, he was, you know, and I kind of like that about him, that, you know, he cares about the people he's working with, and, you know, and it's hard because directors have a job to do. They have a shooting schedule, they have a time frame, and they have to get this stuff done. But in the same respect, you got to take care of your actors. I mean, those are the people that are in your film too. So it's
And you know, we were up for more. The kids, we were young, we were neophytes. We were up for doing more probably than might have been safe at times, you know.
Sure.
I went off to the Philippines to do Missing in Action with Joe, and you know, I ran across a field and jump on a helicopter, and you know, the Philippine Air Force is flying, and the thing probably has only two cylinders working, you know, but I did it because I thought that's what you do. You know?
Right. No, exactly. I wanted to talk to you about the first day that you were shooting the final chapter, and I think you'd mentioned this actually on Twitter to me, that you had actually, you and Kimberly Beck had actually taken Corey out trick-or-treating?
Yeah, the night before. You know, it was interesting because Corey, it was his first, I don't know if his first movie, I think it was, but he, you know, Corey just wanted to be liked. I mean, that was Corey's thing, I think. And he told me in confidence, I said, so what else have you done? And I think that as a 12-year-old, whatever insecurity that he had at that point, he had to answer the question in the way that made him seem like it was more than maybe this was his first job or maybe, you know, it's his second job or whatever, or he had done commercials or something like that. So he told me that he was the kid in The Shining.
Okay.
And I knew that he wasn't the kid in The Shining, but I just let it go, you know. And then he came back to me later that day and said that he apologized that he wasn't the kid that's Shining. And I said, you know, I don't care either way. It doesn't matter. You don't have to impress me, but, you know, just tell the truth or whatever. That was the moment, you know, that was my little teaching moment that probably went, you know, nowhere. But he was a good kind of wide-eyed kid. He knew a lot more about what was going on here as far as the iconography of the movie than anyone else, than the people that, like Kimberly and I, who had to spend a lot of time with Corey. He knew way more what was going on. I knew virtually nothing about it. I'd never seen any of the movies, and I don't think Kimberly had as well, but Corey knew a lot about it. And he was very excited when we first got there because it was Halloween. It was that Halloween 30 years ago, this last Halloween. And his chaperone was his grandfather, I think, who was just kind of a, I don't know. I don't know if he wasn't happy to be there or whatever thing, but he certainly wasn't going to take his grandson out trick-or-treating in a foreign city, in a foreign town. And so I said to Kimberly, you know, why don't we just do that? Why don't we just take him out? He had a mask. He had all these things and stuff like that. And she thought it was a good idea. And so we left the hotel and went to the neighborhood behind where the hotel was. And it was this huge kind of carnival. This whole neighborhood had kind of really done it up.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they had some guy walk down the street as dressed as Mike Myers. And I remember Corey saying, oh, Mike Myers. And I'm like, I don't know who that is either, you know. And they'd done it up. And it was really kind of a fun night. And it was, in a weird way, as Kimberly and I talked about it later, it was kind of like a weird kind of rehearsal, you know, because the three of us ended up in the film together a lot. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like, well, we're going to establish some of the relationships that we're going to have in regards to who that is. I have a crush on Kimberly, right? My character has a crush on Kimberly. And I have kind of this fatherly disposition toward this young kid who seems to be very excited about stuff.
Sure.
So it kind of worked out in a certain weird way that first night when we went trick-or-treating. And it was fun. I remember having the whole experience was really a fun experience for me from top to bottom, and that part of it was really kind of a fun time because it was completely spontaneous, and it just happened, you know.
No, that's great. And you know, I guess during the time that you're shooting the film, you've kind of mentioned in an interview for Crystal Lake Memories a few instances, so I wanted to kind of touch on that. For instance, you mentioned when you were filming the scene, you were just talking about where their car breaks down and you're helping them restart it, and you have a knife and you got to, you know, take a few takes, you know, of this scene, and you have to put the knife back in your boot. If you would want to talk about that.
That was actually at the door. That was actually the door before we enter the kid's house.
Okay.
Did I say it was when they, would I say it that before then? Then that would be incorrect.
Okay.
You know, there's a big, huge, wide shot of us leaving Trisha's house, walking across to the kid's house at night. Gordon, if you look, the dog totally gets in my way and cuts me off and almost trips me. And so I kind of get the dog out of the way. And then we get to the door, and I have the knife in my hand, actually, I think. And we get to the door, and they cut. And so then I put the knife back in my boot, and we went back to the other side. And by that time, you know, they've been pouring rain on this thing from these water towers. And these trucks that are sitting out there, these tanker trucks that have the rain in them, they're sitting in the same 35-degree weather that we are, you know. So that water's freezing, too. And the jolt when you walk into it as they're shooting from where you're sitting there with a jacket or whatever by a kerosene heater, and suddenly you walk into that, it's pretty shocking, and it's slippery. It's just mud. It's become mud because we've done a couple of takes of it. But regardless, I got to the door, and I took that knife, and I put it back in my boot, and I would do that take after take. I think we did three or four takes of it. And on, like, the third take, I reached to put it in my boot, and I just put it right in my ankle. You know, it was me also. This is typical, but I would never have done this to this day because that shot is so wide. You can't tell what's in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
I could have used a butter knife or I could have used a pen, you know.
Anything like that, right?
Yeah, Sharpie, and you would have thought, oh, he's got something in his hand. You can't tell. But I had asked the property guy, yeah, I want the knife. I want the heft of the real knife. I want it to really feel like the thing. And the thing was razor sharp, you know. Mm-hmm. I could have used a rubber knife. I didn't. I didn't tell anybody. I was so embarrassed. I didn't tell anybody. And we did a couple more takes. And when I took that boot off, I probably had, you know, a good ounce or two of blood at the bottom of the boot. And I had to go to the doctor. I went to the doctor and ended up having to have about four or five stitches put in there.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
But I didn't tell anybody. I wasn't going to tell anybody because I was so embarrassed, you know.
Sure, yeah. And I can imagine, it probably hurt like hell, too, I would imagine. I mean,
one of those things you do it, you just go, what? Why would that happen? But, you know, my hand is probably shaking at that point. It's freezing. And, you know, it was just stupid. It was just one of those stupid things you do. It got to the point where, you know, especially as after everyone had left and it was just the me and Ted and Corey and Kimberly, I got to the point where I couldn't take my wardrobe off and put my street clothes on because I was just so cold and they were all so wet, and peeling that stuff off every night was just such a hassle. So I had this big Air Force parka and I would just throw it over my body, jump in my car, my rickety car, whatever I was driving at the time, and I don't know, it was just a bad car, whatever it was, and drive home. And I got pulled over one night because I had all my makeup on, I had, you know, and, you know, the guy, the CHP guy comes, I had a tail light out or something, and he comes and he looks at me and he's like, he freaks out because he sees, you know, I've got, my flesh has been pulled away via the makeup and stuff like that, and I'm my hair's wet and there's blood all over me.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, oh my God. And I said, no, we're shooting a movie up in the hill, you know. It's cool, you know. And he let me go. He didn't give me, didn't even give me a citation for the tail light. Just fix your, he goes, fix your tail light. And I said, no problem.
Nice. That's good. That's amazing. But I was going to ask you, just some, I guess these would be opinions that you may have about, you know, certain things that happened in the movie. And these are also things that fans have asked me to ask as well. What did you think about, there's a scene where, you know, you have your tent pitched out in the woods and you hear the noise, one of the kids has been killed, so you kind of pop up and you go to investigate the strange noise.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a rifle, but you take your machete instead and wander out into the woods, which then later Jason, you know, breaks the rifle out and so you can't use it anymore. Did you ever wonder why, did you ever ask or even care, you know, why the character having a rifle out?
No, because to me... To me, the machete is a much more horrifying weapon than that rifle because it's a close combat weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more, if you have a rifle and you go out, you have to sight it. You have to put a bullet in the chamber, sight it, and you could kill someone from, you know, from a good distance away. But a machete is a close combat weapon. It requires you to be really in close combat. I think from an audience standpoint, for me to have a machete in my hand, that would put the fear in you that whoever is out there is going to be close.
Okay. No,
do you understand what I'm saying, the psychology of that? I never question that. Yeah.
Okay. And then I guess that kind of leads into my other question. So when you and the Trish character go into the second house, the party house next door,
right.
You actually give her the machete.
Right.
They hold on to while you go down into the cellar with the
knife. I pull my little knife out.
Yeah. Did you ever wonder why, you know, why wouldn't he have taken the machete instead of taking the knife? As you say, it's kind of
we'll call it a chivalrous moment, you know. I was sitting in the Fox Hollywood, which I don't think exists anymore, but theater, on Friday the 13th, 1984, the day that it opened. And I had seen the movie in a cast and crew screening with the people that put the film together. And I had my mother and stepfather up there at the time. And, you know, people were kind of applauding the technique of what was going on when the film was shot. But the overall effect of it was, wow, this is a horror film. This is pretty brutal, you know.
Yeah,
and my mother is sitting there going, she can't even look through the she can't see because her hands are covering her eyes. So I then went, you know, two nights later onto Hollywood Boulevard, and I bought 20 tickets ahead of time for the 8 o'clock show the day that it opened. I invited 20 of my friends to come see it. And literally 14 of them, by the time Jason's mask explodes in the credits, 14
okay.
of them are up and out and in the lobby.
Wow.
Only
that's
six
amazing.
Stuck around. You know,
so
and, you know, my friends
so
at the time,
yeah.
You know, I ran with a pretty esoteric crowd, but nobody's willing to hang with this movie except for these six people that hung for the whole thing. But I was kind of on the at the end of this group of people in this one row, and when I went to go back down, after I pulled my little knife out and go back down, the girl that's sitting next to me, who I don't know, says, oh my God, this guy is so stupid, I don't even believe it. And I thought, yeah, that kind of makes me look pretty dumb right there. I give her the machete, I go down with the little knife, and then it's over, you know.
Right, right.
But it's a horror film. You know,
of course, you know, and you know, and sometimes you kind of have to accept those kind of things, and like you say, it just adds to the overall experience of, you know, don't go down there, don't do this, don't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. And also seeing that movie with an audience that were running up and down and screaming and throwing shit at the screen and stuff like that. Oh, excuse me for.
Oh, not a problem. It's okay.
Vulgarity. That was, I got it. I didn't get it till then. That's what this thing is about.
I think
there's this community thing that happens as part of it, you know.
Yeah, a lot of the film critics didn't get it, and still don't get it in a lot of ways. But you're right. It totally is this kind of party atmosphere. I mean, even now when they have, you know, they have film screenings of these movies occasionally, I always encourage people to try to go because a lot of times, you know, a lot of fans are younger now who just saw these at home. You know, they rented DVDs. And so it's really a good experience if you get out to the theater and see it. It changes your perspective completely. It really does. Yeah.
It was a completely – I got it, you know, and I can say – you're right. I mean, a movie critic sitting in a theater by themselves at 10 o'clock in the morning seeing this movie is not going to get it.
Right, exactly. And but it's interesting. So what did you think of the film itself? I guess if you could take away, like, the people that you went to see, you know, or being with the audience, I guess overall, what was your first impression of the film after you saw the finished product?
Well, when I saw the cast and crew screening without the, like I said, we talked about the party atmosphere or whatever, I was a little bit, I don't know, I'm a snob in some way, even though, you know, you could see that my entire career is, I'll do whatever. It just, I mean, I like working, so.
Sure.
But
yeah.
There was that part of me that I was young and it was in, you know, I was 25, 26, whatever, how old I was at the time. And that, you know, this is kind of my debut feature film and it's not with Martin Scorsese, you know.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It
I
was
hear
like,
you. Yeah.
And that there, whatever, you know, my own ego needs to be satisfied in that moment. I thought, oh, yeah, you know, this is, you know, I had a good time and I really enjoyed the process and learning about it. But okay, this thing, you know, okay, this is out in the world now and that's just all there is. And the people that are going to see it are probably not going to, it's not going to make much difference in the long run. It didn't really make that much difference in my career. You know, like Kevin Bacon or like somebody like Amy Steele or some of the people that I've met over the years that have done these movies, nobody goes back and says to Kevin Bacon, oh, you know, you were in Diner and then you were in Friday the 13th. I remember you from Friday the 13th more than Diner, you know.
Right, exactly, right.
Or in whatever other movie that he did. And, you know, it just – it's just one of the jobs that you do in your career. And but over the years, it's been kind of interesting because this has been by far the most enduring of anything that I've done. You know, most of the other stuff that I've done is gone. It just doesn't exist anymore. And in the consciousness of the public or the cognoscenti or whoever, it just doesn't exist. It came and it went. And when
sure.
I run into people and they go, hey, you're an actor, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I I'm an actor. And they say, well, what have you done that I would have seen? And you try to be careful to try to pick out, well, who's this person? What would they have watched? You try to do it. It's always completely – you're always wrong, by the way.
okay.
Most of the stuff that I would mention where, you know, that I had a good run on, like 30-something or NYPD Blue or – something like that, they, or even Star Trek, they would even look at it and go, no, I never saw that thing. You know, I never saw that,
sure.
Whatever that was. But this film endures to this day. And there are people that have seen this movie. And when I went to Chiller a couple of weeks ago, you know, there were people that had flown over from London who had, because I hadn't shown up to any of these conventions till just recently. I think this is my second one with Chiller. Had flown
okay.
over from London because they wanted the autograph on their piece of memorabilia, you know.
Sure.
And
yeah,
I was like,
amazing.
Really? But, you know, okay.
Yeah, the convention scene, you know, has really exploded, you know, over the last, you know, 8 to 10 years, just not only the horror genre but the sci-fi genre. And, you know, people really want to meet the actors and actresses and crew that were part of these films because, like you say, they have endured and people have grown – up with them in a lot of ways. I know I have. And so it's kind of one of those things where, you know, it kind of completes the experience, I think, is just, you know, like even with myself talking to you right now, which is, you know, for me as a fan, is really great to kind of hear your perspective on, you know, your experiences with the film itself. And I think conventions is a way to it's kind of like bringing it full circle and getting those signatures on the memorabilia for fans is kind of a way for them to say, okay, you know, now I've kind of completed that fandom, I guess, is what you could call it. So.
You know, I met people that met. That's how they met and got married and have children or whatever, you know, through their connection to these movies, you know.
It's amazing. It is really something. Yeah, it kind of, when you first think about that, you're like, kind of strange. But then when you really step back even further and look at it, you know, it's no different from
collecting,
you know,
anything. Yeah.
Yeah, you could meet them at a dance. Or,
well, how about you? How did you come to this?
Oh, boy, that's a long story. But I guess the long and short of it is, I grew up in, you know, I'm 36 now. You know, so I kind of grew up with this when I was a kid, just watching the films. And it's one of those things where, you know, I got older, I got into high school, you know, went to college, and it kind of left this whole thing behind. You know, I got married and, you know, I had kids. And then the newer movie came out about 4 years ago, four and a half years ago, and it kind of just piqued my interest again. And I owned all the movies, and I just started really getting into it, you know, being older and really appreciating the history. And I just started writing for a blog at that time, and then I just created my website, and people liked it, and it's kind of stuck, and it's something, it's a hobby. It's a hobby that I really enjoy doing. So it's been fun. I've got to meet, you know, people like you, Dan Ferens, you know, and whatnot, who worked on the documentary and the book, and Peter Brackey. It's been really great. It's been a fun experience for me.
Yeah,
like,
if you talk to Peter, he still owes me a book, by the way.
Uh-oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, I met him at Swingers, and we had a long conversation, and a lot of the stuff that I talked about ended up in his book. And I signed a lot of those books when, you know, at Chiller. A lot of people have that book, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I never got a book. And I've mentioned to every single person I know that's connected to Friday the 13th in some way, when you see Peter Brack, tell him I need a book.
Okay.
So now you're on notice as well.
All right. I can shoot him an email. You know, maybe we can work something out for that. That'd be pretty cool.
He lives like around the corner from me. You know, I mean, it's like you could drop one on my, you could throw one on my doorstep.
Well, I will do that. I will send him an email. We'll see if we can make that happen. Definitely. Before we let you go, Eric, I just wanted to mention one last thing. You're also an author now. And,
yes, I am.
You have a book called Hallowed Be Thy Name. And I
Hallowed Be Thy Name, right.
If you wanted to talk a little bit about that and how that came to be.
It's just one of those things, Jason, of why I became an actor is because I'm a storyteller. I'm interested in telling a story. And as an actor, that's your job from the final. You're the end user of so many other things that have come together, whether it be set design or the script or, you know, the director's input into what it is that you're doing. But you're just part of this cog of telling the story. And over the years, I just got so much more interested in having more control over the stories that I tell. Because I, as an actor, you are just, you're the guy who's speaking the words or doing the action, but then it gets edited and you didn't write it. You know, you didn't come up with the idea or anything. You're just the guy who's doing the end of it. And over the years, I wanted more control. So I wrote for television for a little while with some friends of mine that had TV series that were going. And I like doing that to a certain degree. I like the nuts and bolts of putting a TV show together. But again, you're in a situation where people are saying, you know, you really can't say this, you can't do this, you can't do that. So over time, I was just like, I began to think, is there another avenue, is there another venue for me to kind of be able to tell a story? And so it was a while ago, I guess, I sat down and wrote this book that I put out, I think it was about a year ago. And the second one is coming out on March 15th.
Okay.
And it's just a saga. It's a saga that is, you know, like any saga, I suppose. You know, it takes place over a good stretch of time, set slightly in the future. The main thrust of the initial book is there are two main stories that meet. One is that the five top evangelists in the country get together and set a date for the end of the world.
Oh, wow.
Because it's going to be extremely lucrative for them to do that.
Okay.
And the other is that a serial killer in Kansas who kills people and then brands Bible passages into their body, claims at his trial, when he's finally caught, that he's the Son of God.
Okay.
And he ends up on death row. His two jailers decide there's money to be made there, so they start a church in his name, and the thing takes off.
I see. Okay.
So those two stories meet, and this book is actually a prequel to the book that is coming out on March 15th, which takes place 30 years later. So I don't know if you're familiar with the, I'm sure you are, familiar with the structure of the Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
But they came out, but then The Hobbit comes out as a prequel, you know, that is before all that.
Sure, definitely.
And what I decided to do was put the prequel out first, which is a little confusing to people. But, you know, when all three books, I suppose, and right now, I'm writing the third right now, but when all three books are out, maybe that'll make sense. But my feeling was you could read the first book, you could read the second book first. You could read it in kind of any order.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. It sounds like you could make that decision for yourself. It really is up to the
That's right.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I can see where you're coming from with that. And there's other stories in film franchises and books where they do start off with the prequel story and work. And then later on down the line, people go back and they watch them in a certain order or read them in a certain order. So it makes total sense.
Well, the classic one is The Godfather, right? You just throw yourself
exactly.
in with these characters, and then The Godfather Part Two is a prequel and a sequel, you know.
And a lot of people think that's the better of the two, too, as
yeah.
well. So, you know, that's an opinion as well.
But if that had been the first one, I don't think you would have there'd be some resonance that wouldn't be there because you wouldn't have the characters in the middle of their experience, in the middle of their lives, you know, which you get with the first movie.
No, I completely agree with that. You're right. It's almost like you kind of needed the familiarity with those characters to get the backstory to them. Like,
oh, well, that's where that came from.
Sense.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I totally am on board with that, definitely. Well,
my bigger marketing push is actually going to be for the second book than for the first book. And I've done okay. It sold all right, you know. So
where can people find that book? Is it on Amazon?
It's on Amazon. Oh. Just under my name, look up Amazon. Hallowed Be Thy Name. It's there. You can go to my website, which is Eric-Anderson.com. You can read the first chapter there. That's going to probably be altered in the next couple of months because the second book is coming out, but the first book is still there and everything. And there's a way that links you to all the different places that sell it. Barnes & Noble has it, iBooks, iTunes or whatever. Everybody has it now. So.
Oh, great. Excellent. Well, Eric,
anyone who wants to read it and is interested in talking to me about it can send it. There's in the beginning of the book, there's a web address for my website, and there's a contact thing on my website. You can send it, and I will eventually get that email. So.
Oh, that's great. Excellent. I'm sure. And, yeah, definitely. I encourage everyone to check it out because it does sound like a really cool story. I like how you set that up. But I'm going to let you go now, Eric, and I really, really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to me about this. This has been great and for me as a fan, not only as a person who runs the website. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, someday we'll meet, Jason. It's been fun.
Definitely. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Take care, Ruth.
Bye.
Bye.